Hi, this is PodSafe the UK. I'm Nish Kumar.
And I'm Coco Khan. Nish, you're performing at the Edinburgh Fringe at the moment, and it sounds like it's been eventful. Last week there were storms. This week, Arthur's seat's on fire. So I'm guessing next week we're going, what, Plague of Locusts? A red smear upon your door? What's going to happen?
Yeah, I think it's full on sacrifice your oldest kid stuff. It's feeling apocalyptic. It's actually incredibly warm here, which is not normally...
No.
Part of the reason I think Edinburgh has become such a successful festival is because in August, it's possible to sit in a poorly ventilated room and not burn to death. And climate change has reached the Edinburgh Fringe because, let me tell you, I am sweating my way through some gigs in shipping containers. But otherwise, the vibe is great. It's very funny today because while I'm here, I'm staying with my partner, Amy Annette, and our friend David O'Doherty and our friend Celia Ray B. And Celia and Amy have both gone to the beach, and David and I are both in separate rooms recording our podcast. Men will podcast. You cannot stop men from podcasting.
I want that situation to be a sitcom.
Yeah.
David O'Doherty and Nish Kumar live in the Edinburgh Fringe House with their partners. Who knew what could happen? Anyway, this week, anti-immigration protests targeting asylum hotels have spread across the UK. But rather than soothing tensions, it's the government's response simply inflaming them.
We're going to speak to Labour Minister Sir Chris Bryant, former guest of the show. We're going to talk to him about the arrest of 532 people over the weekend in support of Palestine Action, landlord MPs and the government's inaction over the Supreme Court ruling. Ever since the Southport riots last summer, the temperature around immigration has been rising in the UK. Over the last month, anti-immigration protests outside asylum hotels have spread across the country. The latest wave began with a series of protests in Epping, Essex, following on from the sexual assault of a teenage girl allegedly by a recently arrived Ethiopian migrant.
And like the protests that eventually became riots last year, the flames of anti-immigration rhetoric have been fanned by far-right agitators. Last weekend was no exception. 3,000 riot officers were put on standby due to fears of violence and disorder as Friday was dubbed Abolish Asylum Day by far-right organisers, with 14 protests scheduled nationwide outside of suspected asylum hotels.
Rather than try and relax tensions around immigration, the government appears to be agitating them. Over the last few weeks, we've seen a bizarre publicity blitz from Keir Starmer and his top team. Look at this clip from the Prime Minister. So for listeners who can't see the clip, we're looking at migrants with their faces blurred out, being detained and processed under the government's one-in, one-out deal with France. Now, at the end of the video, the text reads, "I said that if you enter this country on a small boat, you will face detention and return. I meant it." The music underneath is a sort of a Michael Bay action movie soundtrack. Like, it sounds like Transformers or The Rock or something. It's a deeply, deeply strange piece of video content from the government.
You don't expect a former human rights lawyer to be behind this. Everything about it is so dehumanising. I mean, Labour aren't the only ones using social media to showcase their hard line on immigration. Donald Trump's government over in the US has gone down a much more, I mean, like it's grotesque route to make his point. So here's a clip from the White House.
Nothing beats a Jet 2 holiday.
So again, for listeners, what we're looking at is a White House video released by the official White House social media channels that shows people being handcuffed and escorted onto a deportation flight with the viral Jet 2 holidays meme over the top of it. The caption reads, "When ICE books you a one-way Jet 2 holiday to deportation, nothing beats it."
You know, treating it like it's a sport, like it's a movie experience, like it's a joke when it's these are human beings, there's real lives at stake. You know, it's quite terrifying, to be honest.
I think that there is a particular thing that's worth considering from the perspective of the Labour Party, which is we sort of return to this point that the offering Labour are making to the country currently is relatively minimal, apart from the grown-ups are back in charge after years of unserious conservative policymaking. So again, I think it's really worth considering how serious are these people when they are making kind of action movie inspired short videos to put on the internet. What are Labour standing for at this particular moment in time?
I mean, actually, now we're talking about it in a way the aesthetics reveal something, right? So the Jet 2 Holiday one, it's got like the Pepe the Frog kind of like edge lords of the internet trying to appeal to them. And then with this Michael Bay take, you really get the sense of like, okay, so your male voters that you've lost, because, and we know from the demographics that, you know, particularly Reform is much more popular amongst men, the action moviness of it. And when you see that, you really get a sense that it's a small demographic of voters that have so much control that the messaging is being targeted to. Yeah, the dog is being wagged by the tail, certainly there. It's really terrifying.
Now, to help us understand why asylum hotels have become such a point of tension and what else the government could be doing, we're joined by Anoush Chakalian, Britain editor of The New Statesman. Anoush, welcome back to Pod Save the UK.
It's so good to be back. Thanks for having me.
You're joining us from a cupboard at The New Statesman office.
Yeah, it's very glamorous here. We actually do have a studio here. It is unfortunately in use, so I have been relegated to the cell.
So, Anoush, you've been speaking to people at these protests. First of all, I respect you very much for going to them. You would not catch me at one of these protests.
I thought I saw you there, Coco.
Yeah. In my full top-to-toe Union Jack suit. I mean, genuinely, did you feel safe? Did you feel unsafe? How was the experience of just being there physically?
A lot of people have asked me this, actually. I went to one of the protests in Epping, and on my way, I did feel quite apprehensive because I'd seen a lot of the coverage of when one of the protests there turned violent. And so, you know, going on my own, I did feel a little bit vulnerable. But actually, when I got there, I suppose it's just you're doing your job. You know, people were willing to speak to me. I did at one point get a camera shoved in my face and someone asking me, you know, what's your take on it? What's your take on it? Like on the migrant issue, I suppose he meant. And I didn't know, you know, where that footage was going to be streamed. There's a lot of people with cameras at these things who call themselves citizen journalists and they're kind of narrating what's going on. So I didn't enjoy that moment for sure. But generally, people wanted to have their voices heard. So I didn't in the end find it intimidating. But what I really would like to say is that I have interviewed asylum seekers, both staying at this hotel and in other parts of the country, staying in asylum accommodation. And I've never once felt intimidated by them.
Well, I think that's a really important point to make and very much an antidote to some of the poisonous rhetoric that we're hearing. But I do just want to stick with the protesters for a moment. You said they were happy to speak to you. What were they actually saying? I really want to understand why particularly asylum hotels have become this enormous lightning rod.
Well, in a situation like Epping, there's been a specific allegation against one of the asylum seekers staying there. So that was very much the sort of top line, if you like, of what people saying. They felt that their children were unsafe and they wanted the hotel closed down. It was a matter of sort of safety in the community, first and foremost for them. But in general, the conversation usually is, why are they getting to stay in a hotel? You know, a lot of people who live in these communities have been to these hotels for functions like, you know, wedding receptions and birthday parties. I went to Dis in Norfolk, where there's been protests against one of the hotels, and lots of people said, oh, we used to go as a family for Christmas dinner there. So these places are kind of beloved, you know, venues and function venues in the communities that have been commandeered by the Home Office at short notice. Events have been cancelled in many cases. And people obviously hear the word hotel and they think that the asylum seekers staying in them are getting that hotel experience, you know, like a spa and a mini bar and fresh sheets every morning. That's not the case. And we can go more into what it's actually like to live in these hotels maybe later in the podcast. But I think there's an assumption of, you know, we're working hard. We, you know, our children can't afford to live in the places where they grew up. There's not enough housing. You know, our wages haven't gone up. Our town centres aren't being, you know, well loved. And yet, you know, people are coming from abroad and getting something for nothing. You know, that's a phrase that I've often heard. They're getting something for nothing. They're not giving anything back. And yet they're getting this kind of, you know, luxury treatment. There's almost like a competition for resources under the surface there. So I think that's probably the main objection to having asylum seekers accommodated in these hotels that I've heard.
Why are asylum seekers being accommodated in hotels in the first place? Because this isn't a long-standing phenomenon, really, is it? But before 2020, it was something that was it was a practice that hardly ever happened. By its peak, there were more than 55,000 people in hotels in 2023. What's the reasoning behind this? Is it just the asylum backlog at the Home Office became overwhelming and there was no other option?
There's always been a few cases of asylum seekers having to be moved into hotel rooms when there hasn't been enough accommodation for them. But in 2020, this is when it became a sort of policy, if you like. Chris Philp, the immigration minister then, now the shadow home secretary who's railing against the use of these hotels, he was the one who said, you know, we need to use hotels now in 2020 when the, you know, the pandemic meant that there were rules in terms of, you know, mixing and keeping people off the streets, you know, in terms of trying to prevent the spread of disease and for hygiene reasons, we're going to have to use hotels to house asylum seekers. And since then, you know, it's always meant to be a temporary policy, but since then it's grown and grown to its peak of about 400 hotels housing asylum seekers in 2023. That's come down since then. Now I think it's around 210. But it's really because the processing of asylum claims massively slowed down. In fact, a Treasury minister told me the government basically stopped doing the processing. And so a backlog built up there. More people have come over on small boats via that sort of channel crossing route as well. And there's just not enough housing to put asylum seekers into. And so they're having to put them up in these hotels, which weren't, remember, being used in the pandemic as well. So they were almost like spare accommodation then.
Of course, now they are being used. So is there a plan to taper this off?
Yeah, so every government basically has said that they want to close the asylum hotels and stop their use. But it's not as simple as that. You can't just not house asylum seekers because that means that they'll end up in destitution on the streets and there's, you know, laws against, you know, making people destitute. What the government wants to do is try and disperse them into houses. And so now you get Serco, who is contracted by the government, is asking landlords to house asylum seekers in their houses to try and move people out of hotels, which are far more visible, of course, than just residential houses into HMOs.
I wanted to ask because you will hear certain voices on the right saying, we will close down asylum hotels. And it's good to have it laid out how unfeasible that actually is with the backlog. Also, you said the word Serco and that gave me chills. Oh, God. You know, when there's Serco's involved, that it's something horrible is happening.
Yeah, nothing good's going on with Serco.
I do want to just ask about the ban on asylum seekers working. What if that was changed? I think it's also worth mentioning, just in case our listeners are not aware, that the ban was introduced by Tony Blair's government. The aim of it was to deter new arrivals. We could have a conversation about whether that worked or not. But do you think that in particular is feeding this perception of asylum seekers as a drain?
Absolutely. Yeah, I think this is a really, really big problem and misconception as well. When I was in Norfolk, I was having conversations with people, you know, near the asylum hotel, and someone pointed to a Turkish takeaway on the high street and said, I respect them. They've been there years. They came here and built a business and they give back to the community and they pay their taxes and they're part of the economy. And asylum seekers can't do that. They're not allowed to work. So that has, you know, that has two consequences. One, that there's this feeling that they're a drain on society and that they're sort of scrounging in some way. But two, they might end up in the black economy working illegally. And people seem to have, you know, a big problem with that as well. You've seen the way that some couriers like Deliveroo, Uber Eats riders have been intimidated, who have just been, you know, near some of these protests because people feel that they're asylum seekers working illegally for these apps. And so it just creates like a very poisonous perception. And actually, when I've interviewed these people, every time, I don't think I've ever done an interview with an asylum seeker who hasn't said, I really want to work, just let me work.
That's a really important point. They want to work. I did a project during the pandemic where I had a lot sort of long interview with a person who was living in an asylum seeker hotel at that exact moment. And all he was saying to me was, I am desperate to work. The logic of it doesn't make any sense because they risked their lives to get halfway across the world and now people are calling them lazy. Like that's an insane piece of cognitive dissonance there. It's sort of feeding into this resentment. It seems like such an absurd law now that's completely out of date.
Yeah, it's so frustrating for them as well because often they've been working or studying in their countries of origin. So I've interviewed people who've been working as police officers, people who have been doing computer science degrees, and they come here and they want to carry on, you know, working. It's not that they're lazy, they're not allowed. And I think that's that kind of, I think knowledge of that just is very low among the general population. I don't think people realise that they're not allowed to work.
So let's talk about some of the fears that these anti-immigration protesters have around sexual assaults. This was the same spark for the recent protests in Epping. Riots in Southport and Ballymena had the same trigger. Mm. It's a really difficult subject. Obviously, it's a very emotive subject. What have the protests, let's start with that. What have the protesters been telling you about this feeling?
Okay, so the feeling that the protesters have is, first of all, we don't know who these people are. You know, they've come illegally and therefore they haven't come via an official channel. So we don't, you know, we haven't been able to vet them. We don't know who they are. I mean, I suppose in a way, you know, you can see what they mean in the sense that these asylum seekers, they don't have access to safe and legal routes to the UK. And so they've made a journey across the channel. And when they arrive, you know, we don't know much about them and their background. So their argument is we could be letting criminals in. So that's one of the main things. The second thing is more racially tinged, which is they come from societies that have different values from us in terms of approaches to women. There's a lot of Islamophobia in the comments that are made to me from this angle. There's also that memory of the grooming gangs and this idea that, you know, mainly Pakistani heritage men were grooming white girls. And is the same thing happening now with, you know, men who are coming from certain countries and staying in these hotels? I think there's a fear that this is happening again in terms of it being ignored or covered up. The problem is that these are isolated cases. You never get big headlines, you know, when it's a white man who has, you know, been accused of rape or sexual assault against a girl in the same way that you have with these stories that are suddenly being blown up so much everywhere around the country. And so what happens is people tar all of these men with the same brush, you know, that they're all demonized as criminals or sex offenders. And that's just not the case. And they're actually very saddened by it. So some of the men who I spoke to in Epping, staying in the hotel, said things were really good before that allegation was made. And, you know, the community had been quite accepting. But since then, women were sort of pulling their children closer to them or behind them when they walked past them on the street. And one of the men told me, that's really painful to see. I'm not here to do anything to you, to take anything from you.
The clear double standard that when a white man is the perpetrator, there just isn't this amount of outcry. It just doesn't exist. I think it's worth mentioning as well that some of the rioters in the Southport situation, they already had previous convictions for domestic violence. So we want, you know, this idea of being the flag bearer for safety of women, it just doesn't really stand up to scrutiny. Some years ago, looking into some of the security briefings around the threat of far-right terrorism and how domestic violence was a recurring pattern in these perpetrators. It can be quite easy when you hear that these are real allegations and they have gone to the police and they are under investigation. It can be quite emotive and you think, oh God, well, maybe you start to sort of fall into it. And I think it's just important to have that moment for us to say, well, hang on a minute. Like, where is the outrage for the other side? How is this motivated?
Yes.
Last week, a YouGov poll found that almost half of Britons, 47%, think that there are more migrants staying in the UK illegally rather than legally. And this view is behind so much support for hardline immigration policies, and it's held by 72% of those who want to see mass removals. However, according to YouGov, the key issue here is that these perceptions are wide of the mark. Estimates for illegal migrants range from 120,000 to 1.3 million, which obviously doesn't come close to the 10.7 million migrants living and working legally in the UK. How much of these protests are being fueled by a total lack of accurate information in the British media?
I think they are, because often when I've interviewed people who, you know, have been protesting against the asylum hotels, they will say, well, we have no problem with people coming here legally. These people are pushing them, you know, to the back of the queue. These people are bullies. You know, they're playing the system. You know, they're not coming via the official channels. And I think that lack of control, you know, this is why the small boats is such a visceral issue for people. It's a symbol of a sort of lack of control. And I think the idea of people coming through more official channels is much more palatable to people, even the most, you know, immigration skeptic people, unless you're really extreme, you know, accept that we do have to have some people coming into the country to, you know, work for the NHS, etc. You know, these are things that people have told me at the protests. So I think it's a really big deal that people assume that there's more illegal migrants coming to the UK than legal. And of course, the government doesn't do anything to dispel that idea.
Yeah.
In fact, it's kind of, it's almost like a rhetorical device, isn't it? Let's concentrate on asylum seekers and demonise them to distract from the fact that we're actually letting loads of people in via legal routes, which might be, you know, controversial. It's not really new for Labour. You know, this is what they did under Tony Blair as well. I mean, if you look at all of the measures taken to make asylum seekers' lives harder in the UK, most of them came in under New Labour. And at the same time, sort of the other hand was opening the door for EU migrants to come and work here. So I think it's a similar thing that's happened, you know, in successive Conservative governments that we've had and is happening now as well, to kind of elide the two in a way to try and sort of distract the public from the fact that our economy, you know, is deeply reliant on legal migration.
More than 200 refugee groups, charities and unions have signed a letter calling for the government to end the pernicious currents of hatred fueling anti-migrant protests. Anoush, just to finish up on some sort of vague note of hope here, what could the government be doing in lieu of making, you know, COD Michael Bay action films, like sort of montages of police deporting people? What could the government be doing to actually diffuse these tensions around immigration instead of seemingly using rhetoric that whips them up further?
So I was past some research for my cover story on the asylum hotels that has been read, I've heard widely, in Number 10. So this was research into the areas that got hit by the riots last year following the Southport murders. It wasn't immigration to these areas that was a common factor in the places where these kind of riots blew up. It was a feeling of disconnection. That can have all sorts of meanings. So it can mean that there's not enough, you know, communal places that you can meet for free with people around you anymore in your community, because mainly because of austerity degrading the public realm and public services. Or it could mean that different ethnic groups aren't integrated in your community, and you feel disconnected from your neighbours. So it's more about integration and connection than levels of migration. And I think the government could do a lot more to be promoting integration and also making people's neighbourhoods feel better places to live in. I think if town centres and high streets and places to meet were nurtured more by the government and integration was more of a focus, then you wouldn't necessarily have this feeling of disconnection that has led to some of the things that we've seen lately. That's not to excuse racism, because racism is a big part of this, and the far right have, you know, often in some cases organised some of these protests, but certainly exploited, you know, the feelings around them. So there is a racial element to it. But there is that deeper feeling of disconnection that is driving some of these actions. And I think that's something the government needs to be very aware of.
Anoush Jakhelian, thank you so much for joining us on Pod Save the UK. Do check out Anoush's cover story about the asylum hotels.
After the break, we speak to Labour Minister Chris Bryant about the arrest of 532 people over the weekend in support of Palestine Action and landlord MPs.
Pod Save the UK is brought to you by Shopify.
So here's a little bit of Coco Khan lore for you. In the many, many hats I've worn as a journalist, at one point in my life, I was a business journalist. I focused primarily on kind of like independent business, you know, small businesses, startups. It's normally someone who has this enormous passion for something, whether it's like selling vinyls or, I don't know, making plant pots or like designing some cool game or something like that. And every time I would interview them, they would always pretty much say the same thing, which is like, I don't really get enough time to do the thing I actually like because I'm too busy doing admin. So maybe, just maybe, they could have benefited from our sponsor today, Shopify.
Shopify is the commerce platform behind millions of businesses around the world and 10% of all e-commerce in the US, from household names like Mattel and Gymshark to brands just getting started.
Get started with your own design studio. With hundreds of ready-to-use templates, Shopify helps you build an online store to match your brand style.
Accelerate your content creation. Shopify is packed with helpful AI tools that write product descriptions, page headlines, and even enhance your product photography.
Get the word out like you have a marketing team behind you. Easily create email and social media campaigns campaigns wherever your customers are scrolling or strolling.
And best yet, Shopify is your commerce expert with world-class expertise in everything from managing inventory to international shipping to processing returns and beyond.
If you're ready to sell, you're ready for Shopify.
Turn your big business idea into... with Shopify on your side.
Sign up for your $1 per month trial and start selling today at shopify.co.uk/podsavetheuk.
Go to shopify.co.uk/podsavetheuk.
shopify.co.uk/podsavetheuk.
I'm Anoush Shakelian, host of the New Statesman podcast. Join me, my colleagues and special guests every weekday as we bring you the inside track on what's really going on in UK politics, world affairs and culture. We also gather once a week to answer listener questions. Search for the New Statesman podcast in your podcast app or on YouTube and send your questions in at newstatesman.com/youaskus.
Hey, it's Tommy from Pod Save America and Pod Save the World. Last year, 2,500 people joined us at CrookedCon for conversations with some of the smartest organizers, least annoying politicians, and most interesting voices in politics to talk about how to fix this mess. Even President Obama made a surprise appearance. We're doing it all again November 5th to 7th in Washington, D.C., with even more podcasts, panels, and workshops. Plus, there'll be drinks, which we'll need after the midterms, no matter which way they go. Get tickets at CrookedCon.com. If you're a friend of the pod, you get a discount too. See you there.
We're now joined by Sir Chris Bryant, MP for Rhondda and Ogmore and Minister of State in the Department of Culture, Media and Sport and the Department of Science, Innovation and Technology. What a portfolio. Welcome back to Pod Save the UK, Chris.
Hey, thanks very much for having me. No, you weren't here the last time I did this.
That's right. Yeah, that's right. I had absolutely no interest in science, innovation or technology.
No, well, and to be fair, I'm not here in that capacity at all. I mean, I have many capacities. I have many hats. And in fact, because of my skin cancer, I always have to wear a hat these days. But I'm not here in that capacity. I'm here, as you know, because I've written a book.
Yes, you have. You're releasing a political memoir that details your life right up to the point of entering Parliament, which I thought was a bit of a choice. Is that why? Is that... Is there a part two, to Chris, to Brian? Like, why did you end it there? Is that when life got rubbish? What happened?
No, as you said, you called it a political memoir. And in a way, it's not a political memoir at all, because it's not about my time in Parliament. It's about everything that kind of ran up to it. And I suppose that's because I wanted to show that actually politicians are human beings. And before we get into politics, normally we've done other things, just like normal human beings. And also because I suppose I wanted to explore a bit why I ended up being the kind of person that I am today, or why I not just, you know, why am I a politician, but what is it that really kind of motivates me? When I was talking about this with my agent, my literary agent, and with the publishers, they said, blimey, though, you've done, before you became an MP, it's like you lived a life and a half, which, funnily enough, is the name of the book.
Well, it's that you certainly had an eventful life. So you were born in Cardiff. You spent some time growing up in Franco's Spain. You dabbled with acting as a teenager. You eventually became ordained as an Anglican priest. So I think it's fair to say that if your mission was, I want to show that normal people with normal lives become politicians, it's not that normal a life, Chris.
Dabbling. Hang on. Dabbling with acting. I'll have you know I was in the National Youth Theatre.
Okay.
That's not dabbling. This is like, okay, I was... I mean, whether I was any good is another matter. But I mean... So some of the stories are about my time in the National Youth Theatre, both for good and ill, because I tell some pretty tough stories about the guy who ran the National Youth Theatre and so on. But also, I mean, I loved acting, and it was a complete release for me, because my family life at home, alcoholic mum, was just a terrible mess. So and I went to a public school, and then I was in the National Youth Theatre, and I think I was the only public school boy in the National Youth Theatre. So again, it was like a complete release, that whole experience. And I was in a tour of around Europe of Richard II with some people who've gone on to do remarkably well as actors, whereas I entered a different profession.
This idea of a kind of root professionalized politicians, you sort of, you know, you go to Oxford, you do PPE, you work as a sort of consultant or a sort of communications person, and you move towards there are very few of those routes involve actor, priest, politician.
and manning the barricades in Latin America in 1986 as part of my training to be a priest. And oh, and then there's a fair amount of, well, I don't know, what the, is the best word, shenanigans in the book?
I think shenanigans is as much as we want to say without giving spoilers.
Suffice it to say that my husband, my present husband, who isn't in the book because the book stops in 2001 and I didn't meet Jared until several years later, he's been allowed to editing rights. So he's been allowed to take out any of the shenanigans he thinks nobody should read. And there was one story about I get into terrible trouble in as it happens in Peru. I go home with a young lad, and this involves three different bus journeys. And, you know, I've never met him before. And he tells me, look, just as we're on the third bus to the farthest place outside Arequipa, he says, look, I actually live with my brother and his wife, and they don't know that I'm gay. Oh, and but it's all right, because I kind of live in the kind of outhouse, so they won't know. But unfortunately, just as we're getting down to it, there's an earthquake. So
Jesus
literally
Christ.
We have to leave the property and go out into the street, where suddenly, of course, I have to be introduced. I'm the only gringo in town. I'm the only ginger that they've ever met. And suddenly I'm being introduced to his family, and he's explaining to them quite what I'm doing there. So anyway, my husband had editing rights on the book, and he got to decide which of those stories were funny enough to survive, and others which were just gently shifted to the right.
How do you feel that some of those experiences have shaped the kind of politician that you are now? Because I think it's really important, this idea that you want to share a story about somebody who has had a few different interesting lives before they went into politics. Do you feel the presence of your autobiography in the way that you sort of conduct your life now as a politician?
Yeah, I think so. Two things, really. One, I say in the introduction to the book, one of my favourite words is a Spanish word. As you say, I was partly brought up in Spain under Franco. And so I speak fluent Spanish, and I did part of my training, as I was saying, for the priesthood in Latin America. And one of my favorite songs is by a guy called Silvio Rodriguez. It's called Ojalá, and it's a Spanish word, Ojalá. It sort of comes from Arabic, actually, and it kind of means, if only, would that, I wish that. And I suppose that's a really strong feeling in me. I wish that the world was better. I want to change the world. I would that I was a better person. There's so many things, not that I regret, but I just wish we could construct in a different way in the world. So that's a really important part of my politics. And I suppose the other thing is that sense, that burning sense of injustice, which sprang from so many different elements, whether it was, you know, the way we've never managed to have a proper way of dealing with alcoholism. You know, we chuck lots of money at alcohol, but we chuck remarkably little money at researching how to save people from alcoholism and addictive personalities. And that was a really important part of my upbringing. I sued the Metropolitan Police over the phone hacking saga at the News of the World. I've had rows with the Russians. I'm probably the longest standing critic of Putin in Parliament. And why is that? It's because everything in my early life made me care passionately about other people being powerless, because sometimes I felt utterly powerless.
We touched on the National Youth Theatre. I hope it's okay to just say up front that in the book you reveal that you were abused by the then boss of the National Youth Theatre. There's obviously no 16-year-old should go through that. That experience, do you think that is what's given you your voice in a way?
So it's really complicated. And I try just to tell the story in the book about, this is Michael Croft, who was the founder of the National Youth Theatre, died a long time ago. And I tell the story of how he essentially, I suppose, groomed me and then required me to have sex with him when I was 16. And I ummed and ahed about telling this story, partly because I hadn't told anybody. I remember when I first told my husband, I was in floods of tears, and because I feel such utter shame about it. And since I've told the story and it's been reported and it's in the book, some people have been very, very critical of me. And they said, well, why have you never told this story before? Maybe it's not true and all this kind of stuff.
Oh, wow.
Oh, I tell you. And then some vile stuff that people have come up with. And I suppose that's why lots of people never tell these stories, because they're frightened that they end up becoming the person who gets, for want of a better term, slagged off. Now, I ask the question myself in the book, did I feel, you know, destroyed by that? Or no, I didn't. And in fact, Michael never did it again. Oddly, he died just a couple of days before I was ordained as a priest, and I then did his funeral. And the National Youth Theatre, I know today, is a completely different organisation from way back then. I know I've talked to them, and I've been through all the safeguarding stuff that they do today. So this is all a very different world. But I tell other stories too about Michael Guerin-Tosh. When I went to my interview at Oxford, he required me to sit on the toilet and read out an essay whilst he soaked himself in the bath. Now, I didn't tell anybody that story way back when, because I thought that I'd be the person who was looked at as being weird and so on. And I felt terrible shame about it. And I got into a different college. But of course, he was abusing his power. That's part of the thing that's so terrible about all of this. So I think it's important that somebody like me is able to tell some of these stories. And for that matter, the stories about mum and her alcohol, which was, you know, really, really tough. Because others have subsequently been in touch with me. Others from the National Youth Theatre have been in touch with me now to say, look, I've never told my story, but this happened to me as well. And so sometimes it's just releasing to know that there are other people who went through the same, and it wasn't your fault in any sense.
Hi, my name is Mitch Landrieu.
My name is Erin Haynes.
My name is Jennifer Palmieri, and we're hosting a new series called Long Play. The South is the new political epicenter of the country. Democrats are way on their heels in this region, but Republicans are going through their own reckoning in the South, too.
I mean, the South has always shaped American politics. We know that.
The stakes could not be higher, but to win the South, you have to understand it.
People in the South feel really misunderstood, left behind, put down on, and they want to explain that to somebody.
We're traveling across 6 southern states to explore the people, the issues, the assumptions that no longer hold, and what the rest of us are missing about a region that will shape the future of our politics and our country. From Left, Right, and Crooked Media, starting July 27th, watch Long Play Series on YouTube at youtube.com/longplayseries, or listen wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, my name is Mitch Landrieu.
My name is Erin Haynes.
My name is Jennifer Palmieri, and we're hosting a new series called Long Play. The South is the new political epicenter of the country. Democrats are way on their heels in this region, but Republicans are going through their own reckoning in the South, too.
I mean, the South has always shaped American politics. We know that.
The stakes could not be higher, but to win the South, you have to understand it.
People in the South feel really misunderstood, left behind, put down on, and they want to explain that to somebody.
We're traveling across 6 southern states to explore the people, the issues, the assumptions that no longer hold, and what the rest of us are missing about a region that will shape the future of our politics and our country. From Left, Right, and Crooked Media, starting July 27th, watch Long Play Series on YouTube at youtube.com/longplayseries, or listen wherever you get your podcasts.
Chris, you've mentioned a couple of times you're a very proud member of the LGBT community, and you're sort of very passionate and vocal about your support of rights and representation. I wonder how you feel at the moment, just in terms of the ongoing conversation about the transgender community in the United Kingdom. And last time you were on the podcast, you told us you're 100% trans supportive, but there is this concern. We talked to Freddie McConnell last week on the show, and Freddie's was expressing a kind of concern that a lot of his friends in the trans community are considering emigrating. This is clearly a really sorry state of affairs. And we wanted to know if you could give us any insight into what Labour allies can do at the moment to help protect the trans community from this feeling that they're no longer welcome in their own country?
I'm still 100% trans supportive, and I've always thought that human rights are a seamless garment. You can't say, I'm going to defend the rights of one group if you're not going to defend the rights of all humans.
Yeah.
And that is the right to live the best life for you that is possible for you. And that should be enshrined in law. It should be what all politicians are trying to achieve. One of the reasons for me that this is so important on a personal level is that, I mean, I think some people will find it shocking that in my lifetime, it was illegal to be gay completely, even when in 1967, it was partially criminalized. When I went to university, it was still illegal to have gay sex under the age of 21. So all of my university time, I could father a child, but I couldn't have sex with another man. So I feel that sense of passionate desire to protect everybody's human rights equally. And I think of myself as a feminist and a passionate feminist. I tell some stories about how women were treated in the church, I think were terrible. And I fought always, but I think it's both and not either or in this debate.
Do you enjoy writing, Chris? Just as an aside, just because the first time I met you obviously was about Code of Conduct, your other book, which tonally is quite different. But, you know, you felt when you were reading that one that you could tell the author enjoyed it, which is nice because as a reader, you want to feel like we're having a nice time. This memoir is tonally different, but, you know, it's very much you. You can hear you in it. Yeah. Is there going to be a next part to it?
Oh, I don't know. I mean, I do love writing, but I'm very busy being a minister in two departments at the moment, as Nish referred to earlier.
I mean, I'm sort of being a bit cheeky because basically I was thinking about Code of Conduct before this interview, and I was thinking, oh, I think we need some more updates on that because there is some bad conduct going up.
Oh, my lord.
I'm just going to come out and ask you, have you been following this story about Rashanara Ali as the homelessness minister and the tenants who they say they had their lease finished, you know, they were put into a difficult situation because of it. This big question now about MPs and landlords. What do you think, Chris?
I hate to tell you this. I was on holiday last week. I think this all broke last week, didn't it? So I've not looked at any of the details at all. It seems like Rush did what she had to do in the end, you know, in terms of resigning. But look, I mean, it doesn't feel as if this parliament's any better than the last one, does it? And I wrote a book all about how we had to change. There are things that we have changed since last summer. We've changed the rules on what you can and what you can't do as an MP in terms of second jobs.
Mm-hmm.
I remember you asking me last time, what about second jobs? Because you're
right.
Perfectly legitimate question.
But I mean, being a landlord's a job. That's a passive income, isn't it? Well, putting the income aside, like if you're doing it properly, you should treat it like a job. You're a housing provider, right?
Well, funnily enough, I mean, over the years, the House of Commons has dealt with earned income much more than unearned income. You could argue that managing a share portfolio is a job as well.
Yeah. Mm.
Some of this is difficult territory to think navigate through is the honest truth.
Mm.
Chris, and part of the reason we value you as a politician is your kind of openness around so much and the processes and the decisions that have led you to where you are. And I worry sometimes that we're not seeing enough openness from this Labour government. And I know that it's something that we want to see more of. I mean, I'm thinking specifically this week of Yvette Cooper saying that the public don't know the full nature of Palestine Action and the government has proof of terrorism that it won't release. Isn't that an example of something that we should be seeing more openness around?
We should always be as open as we possibly can. Somebody asked me the other day, am I a pragmatist? And I know some people think pragmatism is a bad thing because they think it just means you don't believe in anything. But actually, I'm far more interested in getting things done than I am in having a row about the purity of this or other policy. Now, the other thing is just sometimes you cannot be open about everything. I have no idea what Yvette is referring to in relation to Palestine Action, but I know there's stuff where I see confidential and national security related stuff, which I get asked about it sometimes on interviews, and I just have to go, I'm sorry, I can't tell you.
But it's really important that we know the context. This weekend, 532 people were arrested at a demonstration. Surely we have a right to know.
Well, obviously there'll be due process for each individual, and I don't know, you know, what they may or may not be charged with and how that plays out. All I know is that, well, I trust Yvette, to be honest, on the issue of how much she can and cannot say publicly. Of course, in an ideal world, we'd be able to be open about absolutely everything. But there are sometimes cases where you simply cannot, because you will be revealing the source of your information. And I should say, on Gaza, everything we've seen is despicable, utterly, completely and utterly despicable. And sometimes I feel that sense of powerlessness about it, that everybody does. And you just want to do something, anything, or call on somebody to do something, anything. And, you know, the only person who can really make a dramatic difference in that space is Benjamin Netanyahu himself.
But we could be doing more to pressure him, surely.
I don't know. I think as we overstate what Britain can achieve without allies. But anyway, I still feel exactly that sense of passionate demand for justice and for food, for heaven's sake, and for medical supplies in relation to Gaza, as I would when I was on the barricades in Latin America. I always use this phrase, on the barricades, because, and I don't mean to be flippant about this, but I remember going to the first night of Les Mis in 1985, I think the 2nd of October, 1985, at the Barbican, and I was just so transfixed by that sense of demand for justice and so on. Now, I mean, the novel collapses into romanticism and so does the musical, of course. But I still feel that sort of sense of a desire to man the barricades all the time.
I obviously can't speak for those people, but the people that are arrested this weekend, I think, would see themselves as being on the barricades of this conversation. And do you not find it personally kind of heartbreaking that that same burning sense of injustice has resulted in them being arrested over the weekend?
But I think Palestine Action is a prescribed... Well, I don't think it is a prescribed organization. So you're going it some way if you want to go and support them. I think that's where the law has to take its course.
Am I right in thinking that on the vote for it, though, you've got no vote recorded? Were you abstaining?
No, I wasn't abstaining. One of the strange things about our parliamentary system is there's no such thing as abstaining. There's just... I or no or not there.
Right.
On this occasion, I was not there, but I would have voted with the government. I'm a member of the government. And look, I'm a member of the government. I'm a member of the team, and I believe in teamwork. As I said in Code of Conduct quite often, actually, I know there's a version of what people would like about politics, which is that all politicians should be independent. You know, there shouldn't be a whip and things like that. But actually, I think we mostly want a government that acts as a team, rather than the government that is all over the shop.
I think hearing you say there, oh, the only person that can, you know, we overstate our influence, and the only person that can, you know, do anything meaningful in terms of, you know, justice for the Gazan people is Benjamin Netanyahu. I think that's a really painful thing to hear from a minister. And I suppose I wonder, do you still think our current political system is a change for good? And I suppose a secondary question for that, you know, you talked about your burning desire for justice, making the world a better place. You talk about anger and guilt being driving forces. Would you get into politics now, knowing what you know about how much power we do or don't have?
So I'll answer the second one first. Yes, I would. I love being able to make a difference, even if the difference you're making is only between 2 and 4 rather than 2 and 10. It's a difference that you're making. And I think that that is good. And so, for instance, I'm really proud of the fact that I think we were the first country to sanction any of the announced sanctions for any of the Israeli ministers who've, been at the cutting edge of the worst sort of arguments that have been made in Israel. I think we've faced quite a lot of condemnation as a British government. Keir Starmer has personally, and David Lammy, for the position that we've adopted, both from Israeli leaders and from some of the press in the UK, and for that matter, from the Conservative Party. So I'm proud that we've adopted a different position from, I think, that which would have been adopted by the Conservative Party if they were still in power. But it's we live in an imperfect world.
Nice.
And sometimes I think that's what it feels like in politics. you know, and sometimes it wasn't you that made the original bad decision. It was made by a previous government, I don't know how many years ago previously. And you're simply trying to go, right, well, in this given situation, what's the best outcome I can achieve, even if it's not perfect? So, you know, we've always argued for trying to get medical aid into Gaza. We've always kept on the argument in favor of a two-state solution, even though, you know, many Israeli politicians now seem to be completely opposed to the idea of a two-state solution. We've always wanted to get people around the table. We've always wanted to take other countries with us, as many countries as possible. And that, of course, has to include the United States of America. I can't argue that we're perfect.
Chris Bryant, thank you so much for joining us on Pod Save the UK. The book is called Life and a Half, The Unexpected Making of a Politician. It's available for pre-order right now, and it comes out on 21st of August, 2025.
Thanks very much for having me.
Now, last week, we tried to have an adult discussion about the government's Online Safety Act and whether restricting harmful and inappropriate content for young people is in fact a vehicle for clamping down on free speech and democracy. Technology journalist Chris Stokel-Walker had some great insights. Please do go back and have a listen. But inevitably, this conversation descended into a grubby little corner of the internet. Porn.
That's right. Coco Khan, the only millennial who doesn't watch porn, confessed it's the Mandalorian from Star Wars that does it for her.
But crucially, only with the mask on and with some ignorance that it is Pedro Pascal playing the role. I think that's important because into that vacuum of knowledge, beautiful fantasy arises. Nish was nonetheless surprised to find that audio porn exists. So we were delighted to hear from a PSUK listener, Alistair, who wrote in to tell us more about this. He said, "It certainly is a thing, and it provides a means for visually impaired adults to enjoy sexual content like everyone else. Interestingly, audio porn is covered by the Online Safety Act, while written erotic material is not. This has created the absurd situation where it can be legal to post a piece of written text online, but illegal to post an audio clip of the very same text being read aloud."
I mean, it is crazy how many holes this thing seems to have in it. And that does feel like a fairly spectacular oversight. It hadn't even occurred to me for one second that this would be something that allows visually impaired adults to enjoy sexual content. That it makes total sense. It is very funny to me that the Online Safety Act has led to a situation where something can be written but never read aloud.
Yeah.
It's like a horror movie with a cursed book.
I was quite surprised that you hadn't heard of audio porn. Not because, you know, you're up to date with all the trends, but just because audio porn is like, we're old. Like, do you not remember one of the oldest types of our generation's porn was like phoning those smutty phone lines? Do you not remember that? They were like a pound a minute.
I got too sidetracked by the visual element of it and I'd forgotten the huge market of audio porn. When I think about early porn on the internet, it's just slowly loading, buffering image that essentially came out looking like a magic eye picture. Alistair goes on to say the pseudonymous sex blogger Girl on the Net, who writes both erotic stories and reads them aloud, has written about this. And she has now had to entirely block access to her audio content for UK visitors as she can't afford the cost of implementing age verification, which is absolutely baffling. I guess a question we've got to ask now is our friend and organiser of the Sheffield Podcast Festival, Alice Levine. Obviously, it became incredibly famous for co-hosting a podcast called My Dad Wrote a Porno. And I guess we should get in touch with Alice and find out if all of the episodes of that podcast have now been put behind an age verification firewall.
God, it was also, just as an aside, it was great to hear Girl on the Net. I remember her content from the Tumblr days, which is really making me feel extremely old. What is going to happen to all that written porn of Tumblr? Where will it go? Does it still get to exist? I hope so, provided that no one reads it aloud, I guess.
Well, listen, if you want to read more, we've linked to Girl on the Net's blog on the subject in the show notes.
Now, as flagged to us by a listener, Nick, the government recently opened up a review of parental leave and pay, and they're trying to get comments from the public. So Nick wrote, I have a son who is now 1.5 and was one of the few, so less than 2%, one of the few parents who actually use shared parental leave. I think it was amazing and wish more people would or could use it. My wife and I took 6 months each. It really took a lot of pressure off us to be able to support each other full time looking after a newborn. Many people, including a lot of HR staff, are ignorant of it and the flexible way it can be used. I think many are also put off for financial reasons driven by gender pay inequality. Unfortunately, this means that the few people actually using shared parental leave are mostly richer people. So I wanted to mention this because as a recent parent, it's a topic really close to my heart. Although I have to say, I was following I suppose it was quite a small political story that there was discussion about enhancing paternity leave to 6 weeks. It got to the Lords and then the Lords voted it down. They say, well, you know, I'm sure they all have their various reasons, but one of the main that came out was that they felt it was not really their purview to take a decision on it right now because the Labour Party, the government, had ordered a review. So let them do their review first. And I just felt my eyes rolling back into my head so fiercely and strongly that I might have started seeing things because another review. We don't need another review. Everybody knows that paternity leave is shit. It is the worst in Europe, some of the worst in the developed world. I keep writing these articles about like, oh, the pressures on women and postnatal depression and breastfeeding stresses. And, you know, so many of it can just be drawn back to this problem that there's no one at home to support that person. You know, these are like public health discussions. There's a really easy piece that could be added, which is just allowing men to spend a bit more time with their actual children. But anyway, I found it all very, very infuriating. Nonetheless, if you'd like to send your comments to the government, please do. I feel sad for everyone who is not going to benefit from the enhanced paternity leave that will inevitably be granted because that is modern and this is what we need to be doing to bring us in line with other countries like ourselves and all those women who in the meantime are just sort of floundering at home without any support. I've been one myself. I know how that feels. So I'm just a bit furious. But nonetheless, please do write a helpful comment.
My brother and sister-in-law have had a very recent experience of having a child and they live in Germany and they had a year's worth of shared parental leave to split between the two of them, whichever way they saw fit. And, you know, it's a completely different world. Like the flexibility that creates, it just is, it's absolutely incredible. So, yeah, the government's call for evidence is open to the 25th of August. They're looking for a broad range of responses from organisations as well as, crucially, parents. So, again, if you want to contribute, the link is in our show notes.
And just another note, dear listeners, that we absolutely love you sending in all of these great stories. So keep them coming. We read your comments across our social media platforms and YouTube. Yes, by the way, if you say insulting things, I do read them and it does hurt my feelings, which I guess is what you wanted. But if you really want to get a story in front of us, please drop a line to our mailbox. It's psuk@reducelistening.co.uk.
And there's a way you can get this direct interaction in the flesh. Come and see us live. We always have a spare bit of time for Q&As at the end of our live shows and we can't get enough of you all. Come down and see us at the London Podcast Festival on the 7th of September. Tickets are on sale now. Find the link in our show notes. And that's it. Thanks for listening to Pod Save the UK. Don't forget to follow at Pod Save the UK on Instagram, TikTok and Twitter. And you can find us on Blue Sky too.
Pod Save the UK is a Reduced Listening production for Crooked Media.
Thanks to senior producer James Tyndale and producer May Robson.
Our theme music is by Vasilis Fotopoulos.
The executive producers are Anishka Sharma and Katie Long with additional support from Ari Schwartz.
And remember to hit subscribe for new shows on Thursdays on Amazon, Spotify or Apple or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, my name is Mitch Landrieu.
My name is Erin Haynes.
My name is Jennifer Palmieri, and we're hosting a new series called Long Play. The South is the new political epicenter of the country. Democrats are way on their heels in this region, but Republicans are going through their own reckoning in the South, too.
I mean, the South has always shaped American politics. We know that.
The stakes could not be higher, but to win the South, you have to understand it.
People in the South feel really misunderstood, left behind, put down on, and they want to explain that to somebody.
We're traveling across 6 southern states to explore the people, the issues, the assumptions that no longer hold, and what the rest of us are missing about a region that will shape the future of our politics and our country. From Left, Right, and Crooked Media, starting July 27th, watch Long Play Series on YouTube at youtube.com/longplayseries or listen wherever you get your podcasts.